Our fourth case of the morning is United States against Vella.
May it please the court, gentlemen for the prosecution. Your Honor,
Ash.
Thank you, Judge. I should have introduced myself. I apologize. This is a Palladino remand of a sting operation drug Hobbs Act case. The original sentence was 430 months. 370 months plus the mandatory 60 months for a gun involvement. On remand, the court sentenced the defendant to 240 months on the drug robbery charges and the 60 months on the gun charge, which must be consecutive. The sentences on the four counts for the drug and the robbery were all run concurrent with each other, and the 60 months were added to that. This was a sting operation in which, in reality, there were no drugs, there were no drug dealers. There was an informant who mentioned to authorities that he was under investigation himself for similar crimes, and he mentioned that there was an individual, Velef in this case, that would be a ripe candidate for inducement to rob drug dealers. We maintain in our brief and in our argument here that the sentences were improper, that two sentences for what amounted to an attempt and two for the robbery on attempt and conspiracy should not have been entered, that they were cumulative punishments.
Can we reach that argument given the procedural posture?
Yes, I assume Your Honor is referring to the government's argument of waiver. If that's the case, absolutely yes. The objections here are made to this sentence by this court at this time. What objections were not made previously to the sentence at that time 3 years ago have no relevance here. The cases that they cite are cases where...
Why no relevance? The normal rule is that if one appeals on a sentencing question and gets a remand, the only question open on remand and on a later appeal concerns the sentence, not the validity of the conviction.
I understand that. That's the government's argument. The government...
It's not simply the government's argument. It's the law of the circuit.
Well,
why are you describing the law of the circuit as irrelevant?
Well, I don't mean to do that, Judge. I'm a little bit smarter than that. But what the cases they do rely on are all cases that had fact-based distinctions made in the district court in the original sentence. Here there's nothing factual. It's strictly a legal question.
But whether I don't understand why that matters. The law of this circuit, we've said it many times, is that a remand for resentencing does not reopen questions about the merits, about the substance of the conviction. Now, you have a different substantive argument than the ones that were involved in those cases.
I'm not making substantive. I'm not arguing.
Trying to talk over a judge is not a productive appellate strategy, counsel.
You're right, Judge.
The legal argument you're making may be different from the argument in those cases, but I don't understand why that changes the principle that those cases announced.
The fact that we're talking about this sentence, not that sentence, there's no factual determination that would be different in the remand. But what we're talking about is whether the judge had authority in sentencing him at that time in the second sentencing. I understand what your argument.
I'm not arguing anything, counsel. You're arguing.
Well, that's true, and evidently not a good job, Judge, but that is our argument. I think that the waiver argument is different in the sense that in the cases cited by the government, they're talking about fact decisions that would have then been made by the district court judge in the first case that he could not re-litigate in the remand.
Is there something in our decisions that draws this distinction? Maybe I just don't remember them well enough. Are you responding to something that we've said in one of these decisions about the limits of the remand?
No, but I think in all the cases that I'm aware of, and certainly the cases the government cited, they have the limitation that I've mentioned.
Well, this is an argument that could have been made the first time around, right?
That argument could have been made the first time around, yes, Judge, to that sentence.
And was not.
It was not.
So why is it not a waiver? On the authority of the cases Judge Easterbrook has been referring to.
All the cases that I've read all talk about, in the remand, attempting to relitigate facts. In the two cases cited by the government, I believe they are both enhancement cases where the enhancement had not been challenged in the district court the first time around and were attempted to be litigated in the second case, in the remand. This is not such a situation. There are no facts to determine. We're talking about whether the law allows multiple sentences for what amounts to one event and one crime in our estimation.
So why wasn't that argument made in the first round?
That's beyond my prerogative. I wasn't there, didn't know about it, had nothing to do with it. Why counsel in that case did not do it, I cannot answer.
But you're saying there was no factual determination made when it went back for resentencing?
Correct. Not in this.
No quantities, no nothing.
Nothing. It's strictly the legal argument of whether it can or cannot be done. And it would seem to me that the better part of the argument is the defendant's here, that it is inappropriate at least to punish him twice for what amounts to, I think it's Judge Stevens' comment in Fleming, one event, one crime. The Prince case from the Supreme Court suggests the same. As to bank robbery, it's somewhat different, a little more complicated with regard to the drug cases, because 846 does not require a substantial step or an overt act. In the other instance, they tried to distinguish attempt and conspiracy by some semantical difference between what a substantial step is and what an overt act is, and without success in my regard. The next and only other argument we make is that the sentence here was unreasonable. We grant that the essence of the argument here is reasonableness, that by all the cases and by common sense is subjective. But what makes this somewhat different than might normally occur is that, in effect, this is a life sentence for the man. He's 52 years old, 53 years old. He's got a sentence of 30 years. He seems to have health problems from the record in the court below.
Misread it. I thought it was a 300-month sentence.
300 months. I'm sorry.
25 years.
25. I misspoke myself. the fact that it's a sting operation makes it somewhat different. I know the district court, as the government points out, saw it differently. But the fact is there were no drugs. There were no drug dealers. This is a manufactured crime. Doesn't make him not guilty, but certainly impacts the length of sentence that might be given, especially in this case where the sentence amounts to a life sentence. The district court mistakenly believed that she was bound to accept the determination of the jury as to the drug amount. Several of the decisions of this court have held that not to be the case regarding the maximum amount.
I'm lost. What decisions have held that a fact found by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt can be ignored by the court? What we have said is that when the jury finds something like the defendant distributed at least 500 grams. That doesn't set a cap on what the judge can find, because 500 grams beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't negate the possibility of a larger amount by a preponderance of the evidence, which is the standard for the judge. But X amount beyond a reasonable doubt does prevent a judge from finding that that amount wasn't established even by a preponderance.
I'm referring to the cases regarding Harris and whether it is reversed. I have them set up.
It says that the judge makes the findings for a mandatory minimum when the jury has not made those findings. It doesn't say that a judge can ignore the jury's findings.
I stand corrected, but I think that I'm right, Judge. While government's arguing, I'll look at it and see if I can answer your question a little better.
Mm-hmm.
If there are no further questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lang.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Lang, representing the United States. With regard to the waiver, Your Honor, this was a limited remand under Palladino to afford the district court judge, Booker, discretion. And she said that given that opportunity, Your Honor, she would give the defendant a lighter sentence. She, in fact, did. Went down from 430 months to 300 months, and that's over a 10-year reduction. Now, that was the only purpose of the remand. So just have the judge could then look at the pre-sentence report, look at the defendant, factor all these things in, including disparity with the co-defendant, the defendant's age, health, and everything else, and do what the district court thought fair.
States didn't take a cross appeal, and I'm a little puzzled you didn't. I wonder how you think 28 U.S.C. 994H works when sentences can be run consecutively. 994 says that career offenders have to be sentenced at or near the statutory maximum. When sentences can be run consecutively, does that mean the statutory maximum running all sentences consecutively, or only the statutory maximum for the highest single offense?
Well, here, Your Honor, the statutory maximum under the career offender provision, Your Honor, was life. It was 360 to life plus 60 for the 924C violation. So,
all right. Well, then maybe my question is, how does 994H work when the maximum is life? What does at or near life mean?
Well, I suppose, Your Honor, a life sentence would be, and again, excuse me for not being totally responsive, Judge, but
well,
it'd be life.
I'm not blaming you. Technically, this isn't relevant unless the government had filed a cross appeal. But 300 months, although long, time does drag in prison, doesn't seem materially shorter than at or near life, which is what the statute says the sentence was supposed to be.
In this regard, Your Honor, the defendant was 42 when he was charged. He was detained. He was sentenced. He is 52 years of age. 5 years had passed. He would be given credit from age 42 on. So if you put that 25 years on at age 42, I guess what maybe the court's driving at did it simply amount to a life sentence, and I would suggest,
no,
Your Honor, it did not.
I'm asking about the meaning of a statute, 28 U.S.C. 994H, which says that career offenders must be sentenced, quote, at or near the statutory maximum, close quote. And I'm trying to figure out what that means as applied either when the statutory maximum is life or when you can run sentences consecutively to make the statutory maximum effectively life.
Well, I was
just wondered what the directive to the judges is from that statute.
The only thing I can respond, Your Honor, is that the conspiracy offense was 10 to life, and under the guidelines it was life, and you could give a life sentence without regard to doing any consecutive sentencing. So that's, I don't know how else to answer it, Judge. So the government would argue, Your Honor, that particular argument was waived. With regard to the separate offenses, Your Honor, the government would suggest that the Blockberger same elements test applies, and That would indicate that the sentences for multiple sentences for the multiple offenses would be correct. Lastly, Your Honor, the government would indicate or argue to the court that the, because of the drastic reduction the court did on resentencing, that the sentence in this regard, Your Honor, of the defendant as a career offender was certainly reasonable. And unless there are any other questions, Your Honor, I would respectfully ask this court to affirm both the sentences and the convictions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Lang.
Sir.
Anything further, Mr. Nash?
Does not tell me this, but I believe the decision I'm referring to is U.S. v. Carvajal, C-A-R-V-A-J-A-L, 2005 U.S. Lexus 3076. But I have not read the case since I wrote the brief, so I cannot be sure. But my recollection is that it states that the judge in setting the amount is not bound in these respects regarding by the jury's verdict. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. And Mr. Nash, the court appreciates your willingness to accept the appointment. The case is taken under advisement.